This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas. It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we'll share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, chewing the fat with Rex and Paul, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocals@cals.org. This program is presented by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information about Radio CALS, please visit the Butler Center's blog at butlercenter.org. Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio CALS. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews. This week on Primary Sources, we share an interview from the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies' Arkansas-Vietnam War Project. The interviewer is Brian Robertson, manager of the Butler Center's Research Services Division. The interviewee is James Mitchell, who graduated from Danville High School in Danville, Arkansas. He joined the Navy in 1967 and was sent to Vietnam.
This is Brian Robertson, and we are in the Arkansas Studies Institute building doing an interview for the Butler Center's Arkansas-Vietnam War Project. Your name, sir?
James Mitchell.
Well, James, I always start these off by asking when and where you were born.
I was born June the 3rd in 1947 in Paola, Kansas.
Okay. And what were your parents' names?
My parents' names were J.D. and Maureen Mitchell.
Now, what did they do for a living, or what did your dad do for a living?
My dad was a cook in the military, Army, in World War II. Upon returning to the U.S., he continued to cook. He owned some my mother ran some restaurants, small restaurants in Missouri and Kansas. And in the early 50s, early to mid 50s, bought at least two railroad, Missouri, Kansas, and Texas railroad hotels, one in Franklin, Missouri, and one in Appleton City, Missouri. And they ran those, went back and forth four or five different times to those locations from Danville, Arkansas. Okay. And they made the final move back to Arkansas in 59.
So how did they end up in Danville in the first place?
Both of them were born and raised there.
Okay. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had one sister. Okay. Agnes Mitchell.
Okay. Where did you go to school, high school?
New Franklin. I started school in Danville High School. And my folks moved back to Missouri, finished up, I think, the first grade there. And from the first grade until the sixth grade, which would have been in 59, we made about four trips back and forth from Franklin to Danville.
Okay.
And that was...
Where did you go to high school at?
High school in Danville,
Danville,
Arkansas.
Okay.
Yes, totally.
What year did you graduate?
Graduated in 1965.
Okay. And what did you do once you graduated?
Started attending the University of Arkansas. Went there in the fall of 65 and continued on until through 67. My grade point average was not what it was supposed to be. I was in the process of getting drafted, so at that point I joined the Navy.
What did your parents think about that?
They were okay with the Navy part, yes.
Did your dad have any thoughts, being since he was in the Army, about you joining the Navy?
Actually, my dad encouraged me to go anywhere other than the Army. He said he had been in the Army and he'd rather I go someplace else, and I think he probably excluded the Marine Corps also. Mm-hmm. So I joined the Navy, and that's not the rest of the story, but I joined the Navy.
So where did you do your basic training and all that?
Well, I was sent to the Naval Training Center in San Diego, California. And I spent 13 weeks there in boot camp.
And what was that like?
It was just it was just boot camp. It was good and it was bad. It wasn't all that strenuous. We could see the Marines across the estuary there at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, and it didn't take long to figure out they had it a lot worse than we did. And I personally think I was in better shape going into Navy boot camp than I was when I got out. Mm-hmm. But it was just up at 3:30 or 4 in the morning and in bed at 9:30 to 10 at night, and this day in, day out, and it was just boot camp.
Right.
So.
Right. So where did you go once you finished with boot camp?
I finished boot camp, and I came home on leave, and I had orders to report to Hospital Corps School at Balboa Hospital in San Diego. And if my recollections are right, that was a 12 or a 14 week school. I attended that. I became a hospital corpsman, and I was sent directly from the hospital there at Balboa to Camp Pendleton, California, for field service medical school with the Marine Corps.
Now, being a corpsman, is that something that you chose to do, or were you just assigned to do that?
I chose to do that.
And what led you to want to do that?
Well, medicine always intrigued me, and I had two friends, two World War II veteran friends that were hospital corpsmen. And I talked to them, and they probably had as much influence on that as anybody. You know, Mr. Jack Wilson, who was a lifelong friend, and Mr. J.A. Mowdy, who was high school superintendent.
Okay. So what happened once you finished up your training?
My training was finished there at Camp Pendleton. I was given orders back to the Naval Training Center in San Diego to work at the dispensary there. And at that dispensary, they did super minor surgeries, dental work, and just took care of minor illnesses, super minor illnesses. Everything else went to the Naval Hospital there in San Diego. But we had cellulitis, a lot of cellulitis going on there, a lot of upper respiratory illness there at the boot camp. And we had an x-ray department, and we also autoclaved all of our own instruments that we used there. And I was in charge of doing that for about a year at one time.
Okay. So what did you do once you finished up with that assignment?
Well, I was there at the Naval Training Center for, it was over a year and a half. Okay. I worked on the wards there. I worked in the, ran a central supply room by myself for several months. I was then transferred to health records office. And at one point I was taken care of my job at the in the health records office and the central supply room at the same time because they did not have a person to fill that spot in the central supply room.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there. I was in the health records office up until December of 69 when I got orders to Vietnam.
Okay. Had you been following what was going on?
Yes.
Did you have any particular feelings about the war at that point before you actually got there?
At that point, I wished it had been over. And I really don't know how to finish that question, but it just warred my opinion that we probably should not have been in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when did you actually get shipped over to Vietnam?
I left the, I was caught a plane in Norton Air Force Base in San Bernardino the 23rd of February of 70. And we flew from Norton Air Force Base to Okinawa, and I spent 3 days on Okinawa getting uniforms, and I can't remember if we got any more shots or not. I don't think so. But I spent 3 days on Okinawa on the way over.
Mm-hmm. Where did you actually land in Vietnam?
Landed in Da Nang.
Da Nang
Airport. And
Had you flown in on a military plane, or were you on a commercial?
Commercial.
Plane? Okay.
Yes.
Well, if you can think back to when you landed there and you're kind of walking off the plane, do you remember any thoughts going through your head or first impressions of Vietnam?
They told me it was going to be hot and humid, and that was quite evident immediately. You walked off the plane onto the asphalt. Back in those days, there was no hallways coming off the plane, and it was super hot, and it was super hot, and we walked off onto the tarmac into the terminal, picked up our sea bags, and were directed to military 6x6s somewhere there on the base. And we were trucked through Da Nang to what's called Freedom Hill, that area, what they called it at the time, except there wasn't any freedom involved for me at that time. And I was sent up there to get my orders, and I'll never forget the ride through Da Nang. I come from San Bernardino, California to Okinawa, Marine Corps base there. Man, I can't think of the name of that base now. Camp, But anyway, the drastic change. You're driving through country that you have never seen anything like before in your life, and you didn't know where the war was just getting off the plane, you know. And I was apprehensive, of course, about the whole deal, new country. But anyway, we were sent on up Freedom Hill, and I didn't know what the day would look like. Well, I got in there probably 1 o'clock and 11, 12 o'clock, I guess, in the afternoon. And they unloaded us up there at Freedom Hill. I walked into the office, a man stamped my papers, and he said, "Your report to LZ Baldy, and go up the hill, and you'll get a helicopter ride out there." And there was no sitting down and getting comfortable. There wasn't any shower. There wasn't any steak dinner. You got off the airplane. You was loaded on 6x6, and you were headed to your destination.
Mm-hmm. So, do you remember much about the trip to LZ Baldy?
Well, that was a kind of story in itself. Like I said before, I was super extremely apprehensive about the change in scenery. I had never been on a military helicopter before in my life, and I had never been in hostile country in my life. And they sent me up the hill to catch this helicopter, which was a CH-53. CH, is that right? CH. It is 53. And it was the biggest helicopter, cargo personnel type helicopter that the Marine Corps used at the time. And they directed me to get on this helicopter. We took off, and it was a milk run. They had ammunition on board. They had water on board, medicine, you name it, whatever it takes to keep a war going. They had it on there, plus loaded with troops. And we flew for a while and landed. The crew chief came by, and I asked him, I said, "Is this Baldy?" And he shook his head, "No." We take off, and we land again. There's people getting on, people getting off, ammunition being unloaded. And I asked the crew chief again, "Is this Baldy?" "No." This goes on two or three more times, I believe. And we hit the ground the next time, and I asked the crew chief, "Is this Baldy?" He shakes his head, "Yes." And I get off the helicopter, proceed on down the road, and run into a Marine there and ask him where the regimental agent station was. And he said, "That's on LZ Baldy." He said, "You're on ANWR." And I will always believe that the crew chief told me that was Baldy, because I had asked him too many questions. And anyway, I got the guys put me up at ANWR that night. They called the regimental aid station there in Baldy and told them that I was not AWOL, I was en route, and I'd be there on the first helicopter in the morning. And that's the way it happened. And to go back to my accommodations there at ANWR, they put me in. My first night was spent in a metal building that had the about 15 feet blown out of the back corner of it from a rocket that had came in there. And that didn't do much to settle my nerves either.
But, I can imagine.
It was, like I say, it was a learning experience. I was getting acquainted pretty quick.
Mm-hmm. So what happened once you got up to LZ Baldy?
Well, I got walked off the helicopter, ran into another corpsman there that greeted me and told him who I was, and he said, "Bring your stuff, gear across the road, and I'll show you where your hooch is going to be that you'll be staying in. And we'll get your gear stowed, and I'll show you through the bunker." And I said, "Well, okay." We crossed the road, stowed my gear, and we came back. Was milling in and around the bunker there for probably 15 minutes at the most. And our call sign there at LZ Baldy was 7-Up. And the radio heard this 7-Up, 7-Up come over the radio, and another call sign behind that, which meant nothing to me at the time. And it was a helicopter that was inbound with a casualty. And I'm standing around there not knowing what's going on. Actually, I'm just totally green at this point. And everybody's moving, and they're all moving toward the back door. And I kind of ease around and walk on out that way. And it's a medevac helicopter, a Huey, flying in with a wounded I can't remember if it was South Vietnamese Army or U.S. at this point. I just cannot remember. But severely wounded soldier, and they rushed him in and started starting IVs and working on him, and he passed away shortly after they got him in the bunker, and I had been there less than 20 minutes and watched my first man die, and knew it wasn't in Arkansas anymore. So
yeah,
that was my introduction to my duty station.
Right. Well, if there was such a thing as a typical day, what was a typical day for you?
Well, typical was hard to come by, but you never knew what was going to come through the door. But we started out in the morning assuming nothing happened that night. You started out the morning, you got up, and I always took the luxury of taking a shower if I could stand it. Our water supply was a junk fuel tank off of a F4 Phantom filled up with water. And morning showers were cold. We had no heat. And it was a luxury because there's other guys out there that didn't have that. And it's unbelievable what they had to endure. But anyway, I had the luxury of water if I wanted it most of the time. And I'd take that shower. And again, that depends on whether or not anything's going on. If it's going on, you're just busy. And generally I'd shower, I would take a chloroprimiquine tablet and drink a cup of coffee. The tablet was mandatory for malaria prevention, and maybe two cups of coffee. And we'd get all that done, and at this same time, if things need stocking up for the day as far as the needle, syringes, IVs, whatever we need, we're working through that. And about 7:30 or 8 o'clock, we have what we call Vietnamese sick call. And we had a driver that would take a Jeep to the main gate off of the base there. I cannot remember the name of the village outside the gate. But they take the Jeep out there, and sometimes they'd have to make two or three trips. We treat anywhere from five to, some days we treated 30 on a super day. That's very seldom we did that, but we have. And they would ferry these people back and forth to our bunker, and we would treat anything from a small abscess to massive shrapnel wounds or gunshot wounds or you name it. We've treated it. It's there's just not much that didn't come through there.
Now, do you think that the wounds, were they the result of American fire or Vietnamese fire or both, maybe?
It was all of the above. Yeah. We had kids in there that was wounded from U.S. fire, I'm sure. Collateral damage, and we had kids in there that had shrapnel wounds that I'm sure that was probably packing explosives to do harm to U.S. soldiers and Marines, and I'm sure they were affiliated with the VCNVA or one of the factions there.
Right. What would you say the reaction of the civilians was to you all being there? I mean, I guess on one hand, they were glad to get the medical treatment, obviously, but, you know, would you say that beyond that they were still happy that you were there? Or were they just taking advantage of you? And I know that puts you getting into their heads.
And that's hard for me to do because I could not speak their language. I always had to, someone else always had to tell me what they were saying. We had interpreters, And somebody always had to keep me informed on what they were thinking. But yes, they wanted our medicine, and they wanted anything they could get to eat. They a case of sea rations was just like gold to them. And I don't know how to answer that as far as the general population goes.
Right.
There was one girl there one time who could speak pretty decent English, and she was from the Saigon area. I can't even remember where I ran into her. She had been there on the base, but she was talking about how well off they were, her family. And the area that I was, and she was not favorable of us. And I can't remember all she had to say about that. I cannot remember. But I just know the people that were in my immediate area were absolutely the poorest of the poor. They were absolute farmers. They raised rice, subsistence living. And they were just concerned about health and getting a full stomach every day. If they had that, they were in business.
You said you had to have somebody interpret for you. Were these other Americans interpreting, or were these South Vietnamese doing the interpreting?
We had some corpsmen there and a doctor that could speak just a little bit of Vietnamese. But we had a girl there. Her name was, we called her Mai. I think her full name was Ninguyen Mai Thay Thong. And I'm stretching my Vietnamese when I say that, but Mai was her name. And she would, if it wasn't obvious what was wrong with someone, we would get her to converse with them, and she would give us an idea of where we needed to be looking.
Does she live in the village and then just come onto the base?
Yes.
Yeah.
And she also came with two small Vietnamese boys. We affectionately called them Tom and Louis. And I don't know what their Vietnamese names were, but they came as a package every day, and they would eat there on the base with us. And my and the boys would interpret a little bit from time to time. And but they would come in the morning, the first thing, and they would leave just before dark at night. And they never would spend a night on the base proper.
Yeah. What do you think? Were these her children, or were they just two other boys?
No, they were just village kids. Okay. And they could have been cousins. I don't remember that, but I just know they came as a package. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they were not brothers and sisters, no.
Okay. Yeah. So did you spend most of your time there at the regimental aid station?
For the most part. Once in a while, there would be a shortage of medical personnel for whatever reason, and a corpsman would get killed, and we'd have to fill a spot somewhere out in the bush, or they would need someone to fly on emergency medevac on a helicopter to pick up casualties. And sometimes we would fill in those places.
Very good. Well, I appreciate you visiting with us today.
You've been listening to Primary Sources on Radio CALS, a production of the Central Arkansas Library System, its Arkansas History Department, the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Our producer is Glenn Whaley. Production manager is Shelley Stormo. Voices by Jasmine Job and John Miller. Engineering and editing by Anna Lancaster and Shelley Stormo. Our executive producers are Leanne Blackwell Hoskin and David Strickland.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.